Hello and welcome to the ToxPod. I'm Tim Scott.
And I'm Peter Stockham. We're here to guide you through the intersection of toxicology and technology.
Today we're diving into an increasingly relevant topic, the role of artificial intelligence, or AI, in forensic toxicology. AI involves the simulation of human intelligence processes by machines, especially computer systems.
That's right, Tim. AI comes in different flavours, and today we'll focus on two key types. Generative AI, like ChatGPT, developed by OpenAI, and other more specialised types that have particular applications to a field.
Generative AI, like ChatGPT, is designed to understand and generate human-like text, making it versatile for a range of applications. However, in forensic tox, we're often more interested in specialised AI systems.
Absolutely, Tim. These specialised AI applications are designed to perform specific tasks like interpreting complex toxicological data, identifying substances from samples, and predicting drug interactions.
Indeed, Peter. AI can use existing data to predict... I can't do this anymore, Pete. The sham is over. This introduction was actually all completely written by AI.
Yeah, the intersection of technology and toxicology. That was good, though.
Yeah, it sounded a bit like us. I'm impressed with how much this sounded like one of our sort of normal introductions. But this episode, we are going to be focusing on the use of artificial intelligence in forensic toxicology. And it can do a lot more than just writing introductions for forensic toxicology podcasts. And so today we've got, along with Pete and I, one of our colleagues, Stephen Trobbiani, who has a keen interest in the use of AI in forensic tox. Welcome, Steve.
Hello, guys. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here, Steve. You've got a special relationship with ChatGPT, haven't you?
I think that it's amazing. I'm not sure that I've seen another piece of technology come out that I've immediately thought, wow, this is going to change the world. It's just, a model that's been trained on an enormous amount of text, and then it's particularly good at writing human-like conversations or text back to people.
So it essentially has, it's been trained on billions and billions of documents on the internet, so it knows what a conversation should sound like, right? So it just tries to mimic that, and it ends up sounding like a good friend.
Exactly, or sounding like whatever you want it to be. You can tell it, talk to me in a certain style, in the style of Shakespeare, in the style of Samuel L. Jackson, and it'll mimic it perfectly.
I would love for my, maps in the car to be in the voice of Samuel L. Jackson. That would be amazing. But so that's one form of AI that's being used. But there's a lot of other types of AI. We've talked about some papers on the podcast before which deal with the use of AI in quantitative analysis, in qualitative analysis, predicting retention times, structure activity relationships. There's all sorts of things that AI can be used for.
It was the paper, which we ended up not talking about on the ToxPod, unfortunately, but it was a paper where they used AI to generate prospective NPS structures and then also generate probable fragmentation patterns. And they ended up with a database of over a million potential mass spectra, and you could even probably generate retention times and everything for these. So it's just an amazing tool that could be really useful in forensic tox. We'll put a link to that paper in our show notes.
Can certainly see the danger of that sort of technology, though. Good for us, but perhaps also good for synthetic chemists looking for a new NPS to start synthesizing.
Well, yeah. I guess AI is a tool, isn't it? It can be used for good or evil, just like any other tool. It's interesting that even though we think of AI as being a fairly new thing, it's certainly being talked about a lot at the moment. But I found a couple of papers that are like decades old looking at AI in forensic toxicology. One here from Wiener Spieler from 1989, using artificial intelligence computer software to look at morphine-involved deaths and analyze patterns and relationships. And another one from 1990 looking at the use of AI for reducing lab errors, detecting inconsistencies in the data and things like that. So maybe what they were talking about as AI isn't quite the same as what we're talking about now, because obviously computers have advanced a whole lot. But it's still people have been exploring this for a long time, right?
Yeah. Is what they call AI what we would now call an algorithm? Like where is that line between artificial intelligence and just a good algorithm?
Where they started using neural networks and that sort of approach, where they actually had different layers within the AI that self-generated these different layers to process the data better. That's how I understand what neural networks do. Back in about 2019, Alan Verstrata wrote a good article on AI. It's in the TF Bulletin, issue number 49, number 4, where he explained all these different systems quite well. He didn't talk about generative AI because it wasn't around at that time.
I think someone's put a quote up from that article in the Tea Room about AI won't replace forensic toxicologists, but toxicologists using AI will replace those who aren't. And I look at it every day as I make a coffee and think about implications of that.
It already is sort of revolutionizing the way we do stuff. I heard on a podcast a little while ago that 84% of all data in existence has been produced in the last 6 years. And I have no way of knowing whether that's accurate or not. I don't know what the measurement uncertainty is on that statistic, but it sounds about right, doesn't it? Like, we're generating, as a human population, more and more data every year than we ever have before.
Well, there's no time to read it. And I think also, as Alain Verstrata said in the 60th anniversary special, that one day papers, AI will be the only thing that's reading this information on the internet, because it's all been generated by AI and read by AI. When they talk about AI, machine learning is often interchanged with that term. Is machine learning just a subset of AI? And is it really machine learning that we're using rather than artificial intelligence, Steve?
As an enthusiast and not an expert, I'm not really sure. But I guess an AI probably just describes a whole range of very different things. Anything that we think is smart in an object that traditionally isn't smart, whether it's drive a car or talk to you or predict a retention time.
I mean, a lot of people are scared of this technology, saying it's going to take over the jobs of, you know, their own jobs. But in science in particular, it's not going to generate any new facts. It's not going to find any new research. It's only going to generate stuff that it's already known and put it together in one place. So it may be useful for writing papers, for example.
Maybe it's not generating new data. We still need that empirical data. But what it is generating is patterns that can't be observed by humans. You think of all the data that we're generating now from like a QTOF instrument or something like that. You know, you analyze thousands of samples, looking at disease states, let's say, analyze thousands of samples to try and see what's the metabolome, what compounds are significant, their relative proportions and things like that. Humans can't analyze that data. It's way too much. But this is where artificial intelligence can generate a pattern that... So is that new? The data was there, but it is still a new finding, I guess.
I guess even generating retention times is a prediction, but you'll never know whether that's true unless you actually try it. And it's the same with all the metabolomics stuff. They always say we've got all these trends in this particular metabolite, but might not turn out that way. Who knows? So I still think it still doesn't replace the real scientist.
No, that's true. Although I think it's going to be particularly useful in drug-level interpretations, because we just can't read every paper that's published, but an AI potentially could, and give a good summary of all the concentration ranges that have been found from a certain drug, take into account different metabolism and pharmacogenomics, and write up a pretty comprehensive summary that might take a person, you know, days or weeks.
Yeah, that's a good point. But one thing that it maybe can't do, at least at the moment, is assess the quality of that data that it's actually using. Because we've talked about, you know, interpretation of drug levels on the podcast before, and sometimes you get these compilations, like in Basalt and things like that, which are very useful and a great starting place. But sometimes if you go and read those papers, you might see, oh, this paper, the method they used wasn't as good as maybe some of the methods we have now. Maybe the validation wasn't as good. So I'm not sure I can trust that result as much as another result. So can AI weight the data in the way that an expert human can?
True. I mean, there's going to be a number of problems with it. The problem with AI now is it's very confident, even if it's wrong. Whereas us, perhaps as toxicologists, are not so confident sometimes, even if we think we're right. So even with a drug level interpretation, you know, we would say, well, it might, you know, postmortem redistribution, people's pharmacogenomics, tolerance. We might say all of these things and say, so we really can't tell what this drug level means. But an AI is probably very confidently going to say, this level means this. And so that would definitely be a problem.
Yes, we always have to temper our expectations. I mean, asking the AI to provide a solution to a problem that you have on an instrument is going to give you a very, very confident answer to your question, isn't it, Steve?
Well, I think that's they call that the alignment problem, which is you can train these AI systems and they sort of just come out of their training as an AI. You can't really delve into them like an algorithm and see how they work. So you have to train them to align with your values. But the difficulty is if the alignment doesn't go right and that they go off in a different direction that doesn't align with how we want them to behave, that's the real problem. And the people talk about the existential risk that they, you know, the AIs really go off and decide that they're the superior intelligence form to humans and multiply and take over the world. But it could be as simple as they don't align for the same quality of toxicology results that we do. They think that efficiency is more important than quality and just get results out quickly, even if they're wrong some of the time.
When you say they think, they're not actually thinking, are they? They've been modelled to try and behave in a certain fashion. So if they've been trained to be efficient, their result of their processing will be a more efficient model. It's not that they think efficiency is more important, they're modelled to be more important.
No, you're absolutely right. It's too easy to say they and think, but that doesn't describe it at all. You're right that whoever programmed them has set up certain goals. And if the goal is create toxicology results, the goal maybe should have been create very accurate toxicology results. And if you just say create the results, then the AI to satisfy that goal might bypass the quality and just go straight to quickly results.
Yeah, I think this is another worry that people have about it, is that it will just become like a black box in all of these different forms of AI, however they're being used, that the scientists who are using them will quickly get out of their depth in understanding what's actually going on. You know, it's computer programming, so it's hard enough being an expert in our own field, let alone a whole completely different field. So once that gets beyond what scientists can really understand, maybe it's just a black box and then you've got no choice but to trust it. We've lamented on the podcast before about, you know, current instrument softwares even, and the way that they are used just as a black box, and it's programmed in with these certain settings and you buy it and you use it as is and the manufacturer tells you that's the right way to use it. But do people really understand the decisions that that software is making along the way? That influences the results that you get. So I think that's the concern maybe that people have about it.
Yeah, absolutely. These things are only going to be as good as the data that they're trained on.
But then with something like ChatGPT, a text-based thing, you know, one potential use of it, and people probably are using it for this now, is to write grant applications, research proposals. You know, one of the hardest things about writing, you know, any kind of document really, is that blank page, and you're just staring at the blank page and you've got to get some words on there. And my approach is generally just try and vomit up everything I can think of and then, you know, refine it later. Well, you could easily get that done by an AI model and then just go through and refine it all. It'd need editing.
And as Steve pointed out, or maybe Steve wants to talk about how you dump in an abstract and explain it.
Yeah, definitely. In other scientific fields where I found a paper that seems interesting, but I don't speak their jargon, you can dump in the paper and say, can you explain this to me as a scientist who's not an expert in this field, and it will remove the jargon and explain it to you simply. I think in terms of paper writing, the other thing is it might level the playing field a little bit for people who don't speak English as a first language. And, you know, they've done the research and they've got the raw data and it's good scientific results, but writing the paper must be painful. It's painful enough writing it as English as a first language. So I think these tools are really going to help make it a bit easier and fairer for those people to submit papers to journals in English.
Yeah, I think if you don't speak English as a native language, you are at a disadvantage in science in the 21st century because a lot of the major journals are in English. I've reviewed papers before where it's clear that English is not their first language, and there'll be something in there that you think, that doesn't sound like it's very good science, or it doesn't sound like they're understanding what they're doing. But I'm not sure whether that's because they actually don't, or maybe they're just having trouble explaining it in English. So yeah, I think that could definitely be something that could level the playing field.
Is it academically dishonest to get ChatGPT to help write your scientific paper? What do you think?
I think it's okay to use it to assist. If you said, write my introduction, that may be going a little bit far because it does need the information. But if you've got a paragraph that you just can't condense or make it make sense in a more concise fashion, maybe pumping it into ChatGPT isn't such a bad idea. And like you said, it's maybe some people will have a resistance to that. But those people are most likely going to be those that are highly talented in language construction. So it is an equalizer, I think. It's an opportunity for people to contribute where they might have felt reluctant to contribute before.
I think this is just going to be something that maybe it'll take sort of a generational change of mindset, you know, as the next generation that's just coming into the field now gets older and becomes the leaders and so on. That I don't think they'll have such a resistance to it because they will just see it as a tool. Why not use it for things that just take a lot of time? We can spend our time much better doing other things, generating more results, you know, empirical data, which is the thing that AI perhaps can't do. Let's spend our time doing that and then trying to interpret the meaning of that for society and all that kind of stuff, rather than trying to think of words to put on a page to actually communicate this data to other people.
Well said.
But I guess the flip side of that is that one of the things that scientists have been criticized for a lot throughout all time probably is their lack of ability to communicate with other people, even other scientists, but just the public in general. What do their results actually mean? So if we start using AI to communicate our data, maybe we'll just get worse and worse at it and we'll end up being even worse at communicating than we are now.
Yeah, I think definitely if you start getting emails from someone who used to send 3 dot points and now they send you 10 paragraphs of beautifully written email, maybe start suspecting AIs helping them out.
So speaking of these text-based models, we're going to have a little bit of fun and do a man versus the machine. And Steve, you've got some questions that you're going to ask us, and you're going to also ask those questions of ChatGPT. And we're going to see who's right, who's wrong. Steve, so all right, take it away.
Who's up first?
I'll go first.
Okay. If you could invent a new tool or technique to aid in forensic toxicology, what would it be?
It'd probably be AI, wouldn't it? No, all right. I think what I would invent is an instrument that can analyze all compounds at once without the issues that we currently have with LCMS, like iron suppression and things like that. So, yeah, a generic instrument that can analyze all compounds.
Okay, that's a good answer. And ChatGPT.
That's an interesting one. How about a portable device that could instantly analyze blood, urine, or hair samples on site? This tool could give immediate preliminary results for drug, alcohol, or poison content. It might not replace lab analysis entirely, but it could expedite investigations and give first responders or investigators crucial information on the spot. And maybe it could even connect to an app on your phone for real-time updates. I think that could be a game changer.
Wow, yeah.
Talks itself up.
Yeah, it's very confident, like you say.
It's good at the marketing.
I guess we're limited by our practical knowledge of the possibility of that at the moment, but we're immediately thinking about the problems. How are you going to get the sensitivity? What about the vacuum? Where are you going to carry the roughing pumps?
I think that's a good answer by ChatGPT. Imagine having a portable instrument like that down in a mortuary, for example, and you can do a tox test for, even if it's not everything, you know, a lot of things right there with the body. That would be amazing.
An amino assay does that to an extent, doesn't it? So, well, lab on a chip by some companies anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well.
All right.
Both good answers.
ChatGPT won.
All right. Can you explain how a QTOF works to a five-year-old?
Well, to a five-year-old, what do five-year-olds know about I would say
animals, numbers, letters.
I would
trains.
Say that
they know about trains. See if you can use a train analogy, Pete.
Well, that might just confuse you. I would say that the QTOF's just a machine that can help us detect what medicines are present in our blood really accurately. And it can detect a lot more substance, a lot more medicines than most other machines can at once. Is that reasonable?
Okay.
Of course, let's keep it simple. So, imagine you have a bag of different kinds of candies. A QTOF machine is like a super smart machine that can pick up one candy, tell you exactly what it is, and how much it weighs, all super quickly. It can do this for all kinds of candies, even ones it's never seen before. It's a candy identifying superhero.
A candy identifying superhero. That's better, Pete. I like the AI's answer more than yours, to be honest with you.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's go another one.
All right. What's the most underappreciated aspect of forensic toxicology?
The most underappreciated aspect? I guess it depends who's underappreciating it, I guess. Is it the public or is it our clients? Or
I think the public. What does the common person on the street not appreciate about the complexity of our work?
I think the public probably doesn't appreciate the scope of drugs that forensic toxicologists have to look for. You know, most people, when I tell people I'm a forensic toxicologist, immediately their mind jumps to illicit drugs, you know, amphetamines, heroin, cocaine, stuff like that. That's what people are interested in. But the range of things that we have to look for, we're looking for thousands of compounds, and some of them are very boring kind of compounds sometimes. We're looking for compounds that are found in petrol, xylenes, and things like that. We're looking for things that are present even in the body, endogenous compounds sometimes. So the range of compounds we look for is enormous, and I think that's underappreciated.
I would have said the time. You know, when a celebrity passes away, they say on the news, toxicology will be back in 6 weeks. And I say, oh, yeah, that's about reasonable. And everyone else is going, how come it takes them 6 weeks? But, you know, we know what's involved.
Okay, you ready for ChatGPT?
Yep.
That's a great question. I think one of the most underappreciated aspects is just how complex and intricate the work can be. It's not like on TV where you get results in seconds. Real-life forensic toxicology involves multiple steps, from sample collection, to extraction, to analysis, and then interpretation. Each step needs to be carried out meticulously to ensure accuracy and validity. Another thing people might not fully appreciate is the constant need to stay updated with new substances and detection methods. The field is always evolving with new drugs, toxins, and technologies. Toxicologists need to keep learning and adapting to be able to identify and understand the effects of these new substances. It's a lot more than just running tests. It's detective work, research, and continuous learning all rolled into one.
Yeah, that's not a bad answer.
Yeah, I'd say that's pretty good alignment.
Yeah.
That's quite a compliment. Detective work.
AI appreciates us, even if the public doesn't. All right, yep. Any more?
Okay, last one.
All right.
It's the scenario. Your lab's just set up LCMS, and previously you were using GCNPD for screening. The manager wants to throw out the GCNPDs, but you want to keep them. What's your pitch to keep the old instruments?
Pete, you like keeping old things. This is yours.
They're a part of our history.
Well, that's not going to cut it.
No. There's a lot more expertise in GCNPD in the laboratory at the moment. And just for now, until we're confident that the LCMS is going to be operational for a long period of time, what if it breaks down for a month? We'll be in trouble. So let's keep the GCNPDs as a backup.
You might also say something about the fact that not all compounds can be analysed on an LC. Some compounds are uniquely suited to GC. Although a GCMS would be better, I would say, but GCNPD is okay.
Okay. ChatGPT. It's having a decent think about this one.
Hey, boss. I get where you're coming from. New tech like LCMS is definitely exciting and powerful, but I honestly think there's still a place for our GCNPD here. First off.
That's, now I can't think of anything better.
Is that it?
It was stalling for time with that little intro.
I haven't seen it struggle on this something as much as this.
Is it going to come back
there's
in?
Really no reason, there's really no reason to keep these NPDs.
First off, and now it's just...
There are certain volatile and thermally stable compounds that GCNPD handles really well, even better than LC-MAs in some cases. We're talking about certain pesticides, drugs, and other substances. Plus, having both technologies at our disposal gives us more flexibility in our testing. We can cross-verify results and tackle a broader range of cases. And let's not forget about cost. Running tests on the GCNPD can be cheaper, and it might make more sense for routine screenings. So, what do you say, boss? Let's hold on to the GCNPD. It's like an old friend, reliable and always there when we need it.
And he doesn't drink.
That was basically your argument, wasn't it, Pete?
But, yeah, you know, sometimes you do work on an instrument for a long time and you think about all the blood, sweat and tears you've put into getting that damn thing to work, and now we're going to toss it out. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, do you know what, though? I think this is an area where, like that answer that the ChatGPT just gave then, there's one detail in that which I think has actually got wrong, which is that it's not as expensive to run a test on a GCNPD. That's not true. It's true that an LC costs a lot more, but in this scenario, you've already bought all the new LCMSs. It's not cheaper to run a test on it. In fact, it might even be more expensive because you probably need a bit more cleanup to run something on a GCNPD than you do on a LCMS.
And you need to go and confirm it somehow afterwards anyway.
Yeah, so I think this is where it's getting confused between the fact that LCMS tests are more expensive, but only because of the setup costs of the LCMS. It's not, once you've got the instrument, it's not more expensive to do it.
Those NPD beads are expensive too. Remember them cracking all the time.
And I don't suppose either of you want to have a go turning that last answer into a rap.
So you're going to rap to your boss about why we should keep the GCNPDs?
I'd be convinced if I was the boss.
I need some music.
Hey, boss, don't throw out that NPD. It's still got some great uses, you see. Firstly, no. And then I crash like the AI did.
What's the AI say?
Let's see.
Yo, boss, let's chat. Got something on my mind. You wanna ditch the GCNPD, leave it behind. But hear me out. This ain't just some old tech bind. There's value in this machine, if you're inclined. GCNPD, in the lab standing tall, detects the compounds, volatile and small, cheaper tests, serving us all. With LC-MAs, we won't drop the ball.
Buzz.
I think that's all I had.
Yeah, that's good. So I guess those questions kind of highlighted, actually, that was a good choice of questions, Steve, because it highlighted some of the benefits, some of the things that AI is good at, some of the things that humans are good at, and both humans and AI are good at different things, I suppose. So let's finish up talking about maybe some of the things that AI might be used for in the future in our field.
I think we can all see the potential, but it's hard to say exactly where it would go. I think drug interpretations are a particularly difficult part of our job, and where there's been huge analytical advances recently with sensitive mass spectrometers and high resolution mass spec, and you know, maybe even a bit more knowledge into pharmacogenomics, interpreting what those levels mean in a person remains extremely difficult. So hopefully AI can help us out there somehow.
They're not necessarily saying produce an interpretation for us, but gather the information so that a human can assess it easier.
Yeah,
I guess.
Exactly. So you could feed in a level and some information and it can read 1,000 papers and consider all of the variables and then present you with what it may mean or point you in the right direction of what papers you should be reading, perhaps.
I think it's going to expand on what we're already doing with it as well. So retention time prediction, you know, initially I thought, that's not really going to be that reliable. But actually when you put a decent amount of information about your own system in it, when you train it properly, it gives some fantastic results and really gives you confidence that it's going to work. For example, for high-res NPS, where we've put in 200 or 300 compounds and it's looked at the different classes of each of compounds we put in and predicted retention times for over 1,500 drugs. You know, we take it with a grain of salt because we know that some drugs, we don't have very many of some certain drugs, some of those classes of drugs in our training set, so they may be a bit inaccurate. But consistently, things like non-polar drugs always come out later in the chromatogram. So as long as you use it sensibly, it's fantastic. So if we could just expand on the number of laboratories doing that sort of work, that would be great. There's also the expanding on the prediction of mass fragmentation. So all that sort of stuff still emerging. It's going to be great.
And I guess the idea behind that, Pete, like what's the reason that we need AI to do that for us? It's to save us time and money, I guess. So we don't need to have all the reference standards.
Well, the reference standard might not even exist.
Yeah.
It's possible. And so it's, does give us an opportunity to look for potential drugs that haven't even been run on a machine before.
Yeah.
They've just been invented in a lab. Of course, you're not going to report that drug until you actually do get an authentic standard for it, but it's a great start.
Do you think eventually it could get to the point that you wouldn't need a standard? Could you ever have that much confidence?
Well, you know how we have library matches on MS instruments and other instruments as well, IRs and things like that. When they came in, I'm not sure how long they've been used for, decades, I guess, people were probably quite suspicious, didn't want to use them. You know, you can't use that as a criteria. You've still got to inspect it and stuff. But I think these days people trust library matches a lot more, and probably the algorithms have gotten a lot better. There's definitely still some flaws in just using a library match to say whether something's confirmed or not. But people do use them. People use them for cutoffs. You know, if it's below this match score, don't even show me the compound, you know, in my report. So people have a lot more trust in them now. And I think AI, maybe people will have a lot more trust in that in the future as well. It might get to the point where you trust an AI once it's developed enough to tell you whether something is confirmed or not.
And I think like everything in our field, it would just come down to validation. You know, someone just has to really extensively run those tests and prove it either way.
I guess the problem is, like we see, you know, with instruments now, the marketing of whatever these various AI systems are coming out, these models, I'm guessing they're going to be sold in the future. Like there's a lot of access to free things at the moment. People are generating their own within their labs if they're doing particular applications, but they're going to be sold at some point. The marketing can really get ahead of the reality. And we see that with instruments where they're hyped up to be able to do all these different things, and you get them in and you find out, well, they actually can't do everything as well as what they're claimed. And that's probably going to be the reality with some of these AI things as well.
So what about experimental design, things like that, whether you're trying to extract certain drugs? It's very easy to get an AI model to train on the polarity of drugs just based on the SMILES code. When I say very easy for other people to do it, not me. But that could be used in terms of developing the correct extraction procedure. We often do that a little bit by experience now. So who knows, it may produce a bunch of different opportunities or different extraction regimes to best extract drugs from matrices.
Yeah, even coming up with validation experiments and like feed into it your guidelines, whatever the ones are that you're following. Here, these are the things I have to tick off. Design an experiment for the analysis of this drug in this sample according to these guidelines. Again, it's not something a human can't do, but it just saves so much time to get someone to generate all of that for you and then just have a read through and see if there's anything that's missed or gotten wrong. I wonder if you could get AI to audit laboratories, you know, feed in the standard operating procedures that laboratories have, maybe feed in some of the quality incidents and things like that as well from that lab and the standard that they're supposed to be adhering to, and get it to see what they're complying with and where they might not be complying with. So you, not that that would do the whole audit, but then at least it could give you some areas to target.
That's an interesting application. It all depends on how the information is fed into it. But yeah, it could be in the future a way to look at.
I think one thing where we're already doing this to some extent, but I think it will get a lot better is, you know, we do a lot of experiments now on animals to find out toxicity of substances and things like that, the way, you know, brains react to psychoactive substances. If we can get AI to better understand the way that the brain and the body works, we can potentially do those experiments without actually having to use any live subjects, animals or humans, I guess. Not that humans are experimented on necessarily, but in a sense, medicine is all one great big experiment. We're trying new things and seeing what works and what doesn't work, and then, you know, iterating from there. So that's already being done, but I think that will advance a lot more in the next 20 years.
Or little zebrafish. Always feel sorry for them.
Yeah, they're always the victims, aren't they?
It's something that maybe has fallen out of favor a little bit, is the sort of in silico metabolite generation. Seemed to be a bigger thing a few years ago, but I think it's inevitable, isn't it, that once the models get good enough, why would you not do it in silico? Why would you give a poor rat these drugs or the zebrafish?
Yeah.
Another thing that it's really going to be useful for is allowing people who don't know how to code write computer code, because it is incredibly good at, if you just describe, I want an Excel Visual Basic macro that does X, Y, and Z, and it will spit it out and do it pretty well. And then you can paste it into Excel and it'll start working. So I think it just frees up a lot of people who would otherwise have to spend years learning how to code. It'll allow them to do it without having to do that training.
Yeah, it does take years to learn how to code, whether that's Visual Basic or R or, you know, one of these other languages that people are using now.
Yeah, democratizing tool.
And there's downsides in that if you don't understand the overall architecture, you might write some terrible code that doesn't link up well with other things. But for simple stuff, for what we've had a look at so far, it seems to work pretty well.
Well, I think AI is an amazing tool that we can use in forensic toxicology. We're sort of just starting out. Who really knows where it's going to go? You know, by the time I've finished my career, it's going to be in a different place probably. It's hard to predict all of these things, but it is a tool that we have to use whether we like it or not, because we're generating so much data now, both empirical data that we're getting from our instruments and in terms of the number of publications that are coming out. It's just impossible for human beings to assess all of that and find the patterns within that. We're going to have to use AI. Hopefully, we will use it wisely and for good purpose.
I'm hoping that forensic toxicologists can become as familiar as possible as they can with it, because there's going to be people out there commercializing AI systems in instrumentation, and they need to understand what the manufacturers are actually doing and whether it is actually doing what they say it's doing. At the moment, we still don't know what goes on inside a QTOF for some of the algorithms it uses. It's only going to get worse, so let's keep up with it if we can.
And I think I'm optimistic about our field taking it on well, because we simultaneously have to change a lot. There's been a lot of technological advancements, but at the same time, the accuracy of our results is so important, we naturally have to be very cautious as well. And so that's probably not a bad mindset to go into this sort of AI change with, that you have to accept the technological change, but you have to also be very cautious.
Validate, Steve.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a good place to finish off. And let's end with this. I asked ChatGPT to write a haiku about forensic toxicology, and this is what it wrote. An unknown poison, forensic toxicology, justice will be served. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Registration is now open for the 61st annual TAFT meeting, taking place from the 2nd to the 6th of September 2024 in St. Gallen, Switzerland. The early bird rate is only available until May 31st, so be sure to register soon for the reduced rate at www.taft2024.org. We look forward to welcoming you to St. Gallen for an inspiring, engaging, and enlightening conference.